From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Good afternoon and welcome to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. Glad you guys can be with us this afternoon, and our topic today is dysfunctional families. Before we get into it, I do want to remind you that if you can't stay with us for the entire half hour, you can get the podcast at KUAR.org just by clicking on podcast. You'll find this topic as well as many of the other topics right there. We hear a lot about family values these days. Families really are the center of our individual understanding of ourselves in relationship to the world around us. When you are very young, the common thought is that your family is just like every other family. As we mature, we often begin to see differences between our own family and our friends' families. Probably most of us, by the time we reach adulthood, think that especially our family is definitely dysfunctional. What changes in the understanding of dysfunctional families has taken place from the older generation to the very young generation? And did the older generation even recognize dysfunctions within a family? And is there a young person who does not think their family is dysfunctional? My guest speaking from the older generation today and joining us from Fayetteville, Arkansas is Dr. Philip Trapp. He happens to be 84 years old. He's a professor emeritus up there at U of A, and he's still a practicing clinical psychologist there in Fayetteville, and he began his work at U of A in 1951. Dr. Trapp, welcome to the program today.
Well, thank you.
And then speaking from the middle generation is Dr. Dan Newharth. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist with a doctorate in clinical psychology, a popular speaker, college educator, and award-winning journalist. He specializes in helping adults cope with the challenges of unhealthy family control, and he lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. And his latest book is Secrets You Keep From Yourself, How to Stop Sabotaging Your Happiness. And he joins us today from Green Bay, California. Dr. Newharth, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And then speaking from the younger generation and joining us from Hot Springs is Rusty Scoggins. He's a young man who is a consultant and systems engineer there in Hot Springs. Rusty, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
Dysfunctional families. Start with you in the middle generation, Dr. Newharth. Can you kind of give us a definition that we can work around that sort of describes what a dysfunctional family is, at least from your perspective in that middle generation?
You know, I think that all families have challenges and problems. There are no perfect families. When we talk about dysfunction, we're really talking about a family that's not doing its job that a healthy family should be. And you see it, things like communication is often very indirect, or there are a lot of rules like don't ask why or don't say no. You're discouraged from dissenting or questioning. And emotions are often discouraged. And love, for example, may be very conditional on a parent's part. You know, they may express love towards their children until the child does something wrong, and then it feels like the love is taken away. So those are kind of examples of what I would term more of a dysfunctional rather than a healthier family. They can increase or decrease with age, the age of the children, or events in a family's life. You know, sometimes crises can kick off like a job loss, or sometimes families go through cycles, and if they have a family crisis, unhealthier tendencies can tend to increase, or if there are good times, they may tend to decrease. So, you know, it's really different for every family.
Well, let me jump back then to Dr. Philip Trapp in that older generation. Dr. Trapp, I'm curious, since you started your work in 1951, was the word dysfunctional family, was that even in the lexicon of psychological discussions with family situations such as Dr. Newharth just mentioned?
Really, it wasn't, because family therapy really got started in about the middle 1950s. Actually, the way I look at it, this whole process began, I think, really with Dr. Bach, Benjamin Bach's book, which came out right after World War II. It was on common sense approach to infancy and child care. And the interesting thing is that Dr. Benjamin Bach had 6 years of analysis at Psychoanalytic Institute in New York. So he was taking off pretty much on the psychoanalytic approach, which actually I think really would be, you might say, the beginning of the whole process of family therapy. Because actually, if we can say one thing that everybody agrees on with about Freud, was that he stressed the importance of childhood training and the importance of what happens to the child in the preschool years. So when we began then to see children having problems, why we started thinking in terms of what were the family dynamics. So actually all of this began in the early 1950s, and that was just about the time that, as you say, I finished my training, and so I wasn't really too caught up at that time in family dynamics.
In the families that you were growing up around you, within your family, your friends' families, what did you recognize then that we would now call dysfunctional?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say pretty much everything that happened, because you see, in the pre-Spockian era, the child was sort of seen as a person that was to not really be looked upon other than just simply a member of the family, and he was to follow the authoritarian rule of the family. And the traditional upbringing was seen as the way to treat children. For example, a lot of the things that happened to me growing up would be considered child abuse today. Like, for example, it was common practice back in the 20s. If you disobeyed, if you lied, if you cheated or did anything wrong, you went out to the woodshed. So actually, the parent who was considered a good parent was really an authoritarian parent who made things pretty much black or white for the kids growing up. So we knew exactly what we had to do, and there was no permissiveness, as it were, towards the role of the child in the family. Now, the important thing, though, I think, is that even though we were treated, you know, rather severely in terms of the punishment routine, we never felt that our parents did not love us. We felt that what was happening was our behavior was being punished, not us as the individual.
Well, let's move up a little bit to the middle generation with Dr. Dan Neuharth. Dr. Neuharth, what we heard Dr. Trapp talk about, is that what you were familiar with?
You know, I'm 54 years old, and I'm right in the middle of the baby boomers, so post-World War II. In fact, it's very interesting that Dr. Trapp brought up Benjamin Spock's book, because I remember my mother telling me years later that, you know, she went right out and bought it, and that it was a revelation to her, this book that told you, you know, how to raise children, that sometimes just letting them cry wasn't the best thing, and that no one ever talked about that before this book came out, at least in you know, the generations of her family. So I think my parents' generation, and therefore my upbringing, was a real transition where my parents were struggling with sort of the old way, very much as Dr. Trapp described it, of if you did something as a child that was wrong, that was the focus, and not much attention paid to the whole family, whether there was maybe something healthy or unhealthy in the family. And so I never thought about that, or you know, it wasn't until years later when I actually began my training that I even began to think about the kind of upbringing I had and question whether it was healthy or optimal or even normal. The word dysfunctional family hadn't caught on yet. That really wasn't until the 70s. And, you know, a lot of the recovery movement, recovery from alcoholism and books along those lines brought that into vogue. So at that point, I was already out of the home. But if we would think of families, although we didn't use the word dysfunctional, I think we would think of families that maybe where they had an alcoholic parent or were in some way just sort of different from every family, you know, the families that no one would really ever quote-unquote talk about.
Mm-hmm.
We really didn't have a name for them, and it was just something, and then everyone else was kind of trying to be a good family or a model family. Whether we were or not is another question.
Still the Beavers.
I think that's right. I mean, I grew up on Leave It to Beaver.
So let me interrupt by saying, you know, that I grew up in the Depression, and families were really well knitted together because they were fighting a common problem, survival. And everyone had to sort of pitch in and do their work and contribute to it. And the whole neighborhood was, you know, very close-knit. I think that had a lot to do with everyone knowing what everybody else was doing and how other families were treating their kids. So we never thought, you know, that anyone was being treated differently.
Well, now we're going to hear, I think, a little bit different perspective on that. Rusty Scoggins, you've had a chance to listen to that older generation and middle generation perspective. What's it like for people your age?
Well, I think that it's different than it has ever been in the past. A number of things happened in my youth and in my lifetime to change the basic family structure as a whole, I think. Things that had never really happened in a widespread societal way as a whole. We had the almost complete death of the stay-at-home mother. And at least by my understanding and talking to my grandfather and such about things when I was very young and seeing old movies and such, you get the idea that the mother was the linchpin of the family, at least in generations past, that she did the cleaning, she made sure everyone was taken care of and that they were taking care of themselves. She was sort of the barometer of the family in a lot of ways. And that whole ideal just kind of went away because of the decline of the average American income, perhaps, or of middle America. But especially in the younger generation now, it's almost uncommon to have a stay-at-home mother unless you're very wealthy.
Your cohort group, what are they experiencing in the family now that you would call dysfunctional?
That's a good question. It's difficult to answer. Sometimes a dysfunctional family seems to be created simply by one person being dysfunctional and casting that dysfunction throughout the structure of the family as a whole. It seemed like I had girlfriends who never wanted to go home because either they were dysfunctional with their family or because of their family. In fact, when I was growing up, the only real barometer I had, speaking of television shows, was perhaps the Huxtable family on The Cosby Show. Every other family was, at least in one way or another, functioning in a way that was perhaps not what we all had implanted in our ideal or highly functioning family, although I'm still not sure what that word means, or that there's even a barometer to measure it. In one way or another, you tend to see everyone as being dysfunctional, but I think that the new functional family is the one that loves each other and has a reasonable amount of discipline, whatever that might mean today, because you can't really freely even spank your children anymore. And I grew up getting spanked by my grandfather or at school even, and it's changed quite a bit in terms of the definition of a functional family being one that perhaps stays together and doesn't have any felony records and survives with the two working parents and latchkey children. That seems to be the normal family these days.
Well, let me back it up a little bit to Dr. Newharth's generation again. Dr. Newharth, in listening to Rusty Scoggins talk about they are the generation that has suffered the effects of things that have happened from the previous generation, yours and the older generation, what was it about your generation that maybe increased the amount of dysfunction within families? Was it, as he says, the mother being out of the home?
You know, I'm not sure that dysfunction did increase. Maybe. I mean, I think Rusty's point about the change in working moms is an excellent point, and that surely was a change. But I think that dysfunction, verbal abuse, emotional abuse, belittling, treating people as property, treating people as not equals, I think that's happened since the beginning of time. I think what's changed politically and socially in the Western world, for sure, is that we're talking about it and there's more awareness. I think there were dysfunctional families two generations ago, three, four, five, as far back as you go. We just didn't have a name for it or we thought it was normal.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And the recognition that there is a dysfunction is a big part of that, too.
Well, Dr. Trapp, let me come back to your generation again, because we've pretty well established from what you said that things had a normalcy to them. But underneath that normalcy, did you see the alcoholic family or the abusive family within your communities? And how were they handled within the effects they might have been creating on their own families? Or did people just not consider talking about it?
During the Depression, money was so scarce and jobs were so few, you know, unemployment was up to 35% during the 30s. So really, there was very little opportunity for husbands, fathers to come home drunk and things of that sort. So everybody was so task-oriented to survive. The child felt a very vital part of the survival of the family. But one thing I would like to throw into it, I've noticed clients coming to me now are using the term very quickly, saying, I come from a dysfunctional family. In some cases, this is an excuse for not facing up to their own problems. I'm maladjusted, but I'm maladjusted because I came from a dysfunctional family, and they're blaming the family on it. And it seems to me that what we sort of tend to do, don't we, and our Bert on this here, maybe he could say something about this, but it seems like we declare a family dysfunctional when we have a member in that family who's maladjusted. If nobody's maladjusted, it's a functional family.
We're talking about dysfunctional families here today on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. If you're just joining us, that the voice you just heard there was Dr. Dan Neuharth. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist joining us from California, and his latest book is Secrets You Keep From Yourself, How to Stop Sabotaging Your Happiness. Our older generation guest is Dr. Philip Trapp, who joins us from Fayetteville. He's a professor emeritus up there at U of A, still a practicing clinical psychologist, and our younger generation guest joining us from Hot Springs is Rusty Scoggins, who's a consultant and systems engineer there in Hot Springs. Rusty, I'd like to come back to you and that younger generation. Dr. Trapp mentioned just a few minutes ago about the fact that everybody was so busy in their families with the responsibilities during the Depression time and coming out of that. As I look at your younger generation, it seems like you guys are totally busy, even down to your fingertips where you're doing texting all the time. Is your generation busy in a different sense that has impact on the dysfunctional family topic we're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Communication technology has developed to the point where you're almost always in touch with the people that you choose to be, and it really never stops. You've got more spare time at work between jobs or shifts, perhaps, or duties or tasks, at least in some of the industries that I'm familiar with. And then you've got all these mobile devices on you, so you're always engrossed at something. In a lot of ways, your spare time is filled up with communication as well these days. You almost can't get away from it. Email, it never ends. It can be a way to keep the dysfunction going by talking about it to someone else other than the people that perhaps would best be able to help and deal with the situation, or it can be a way to rapidly address it. As far as I know, most of the people in my life, I've seen it used as a way to talk around the situation or to avoid it. You can email all your other friends so that you don't have to deal with one particular dysfunction or another. For instance, my soon-to-be ex-wife was rapid cycling bipolar disorder, and that was one way to keep the dysfunction going by not directly being able to address it with her because I never really knew what the problem was. I knew she was switching antidepressants and medication constantly and that nothing I ever did was good enough, it felt like to me. I mean, she ended up leaving me and running off with an alcoholic and taking my son, so I guess what was said earlier was pretty well correct in that it is kind of a two-edged sword. There's a person that may or may not have a dysfunction in a family or multiple persons, and then there's the other family member's ability or inability to deal with that situation, whether it's because of education or training or lack of understanding. I suppose in a lot of ways the best way to solve those kinds of situations is to have everyone take accountability for their understanding or lack of understanding and directly address it and try and find some middle ground where everyone can help everyone else. I mean, that, to me, seems to be the ideal way to go from being dysfunctional to being functional again. Unfortunately, you can't force anyone to do something they don't want to do, and if only one person wants to communicate, then you don't have a couple, a team, or a family at all.
Dan Neuharth, let me come back to you in that middle generation perspective there. As your generation is getting older now, you're in your middle years, do you recognize things happening within your generation that you would now call dysfunctional that maybe you would not have when you were younger?
I think it's a good question, and I don't know the answer. I mean, my bias is that you can't heal a wound until you take stock of it. In an emotional wound, you have to know you've been wounded, and you have to see what happened, and you have to let it heal. And it's a long way of saying I don't really know the answer to your question. My impression is that, no, I don't necessarily think that there's more dysfunctional behaviors as we age. In fact, some surveys say people tend to get happier as they age. Now, people around them may not be so happy with them, which is kind of a definition of dysfunctional relationships, but you know, I just don't know.
Well, Rusty Scoggins, let me ask you, is your generation generally more aware of the effects of dysfunction as you have been growing up? Are you guys beginning to take matters into your own hand for your self-awareness to cure yourselves?
I have to say that I think that that's true, but in the final analysis, since my self-perception must by its nature be at least somewhat biased, I kind of look to the people around me to see the friendships that I have and whether and the relationships with mates and partners and friends to see whether or not those relationships are healthy. And that's kind of the benchmark by which I've tried to measure my own function or dysfunction, as the case may be.
Maybe I should have asked the question in a different way. Do you recognize dysfunction amongst your cohort group or the parents of your cohort group?
Yeah.
Do you recognize it easier?
I think so.
Well, what do you do when you recognize it? Do you confront it or do you avoid it?
I think that depends upon the person. I tend to confront it because my past experiences have taught me that that's the best way to address it. If I can't get through to a particular person, then after a certain point I'll quit trying. But yes, if I notice it, I do try to address it or at least talk about it. And you have to be at least somewhat sympathetic to this person, even if they're not aware of their dysfunction, because you don't want to push too hard. It's kind of, I look at it as the same way as they talk about alcoholics and drug addicts and such. You can't make them change, only they can change themselves. But if you can increase their perception or their awareness of a potential problem, then perhaps you can help in some way.
Rusty, how difficult is it to grow up in what you would call a dysfunctional family?
I guess it's a little bit disheartening and heart-wrenching and heartbreaking, because we all want the best for the people that we love and care about. And dysfunction can get in the way of those things, and you may or may not be able to make a difference in someone's life in that way.
Well, Dr. Newhart, in listening to Rusty speak about what you probably hear a lot of, what kind of advice would you give someone like Rusty in that younger generation who's dealing with a family that is fairly dysfunctional?
Rusty, I think you put the dilemma pretty eloquently. I mean, it's hard to watch and see a person you care about be unhappy and suffer, but ultimately, you can't live another person's life for them. And so I think it's really a balance of, doing what you can, but recognizing that there's a certain amount of letting go that's part of all of life. I mean, you let go and sort of have losses from the moment you're born. And seeing parents age or other family members suffer is so much a part of life, and it's not easy. You know, you have to live your own life.
Is there any upside or any positive that can be gained from living with a dysfunctional family?
I think it makes you stronger, because you understand life's blows and complications perhaps a little bit earlier than someone in a normal family would, because perhaps you have to deal with those situations and those challenges earlier. And the upside to being able to do that is that it makes you stronger.
Dr. Newhart, do you see an upside?
I think there's a potential upside, and that's that you have the opportunity to find ways to deal with adversity, because you have so much of it. As Rusty said, to strengthen you, potentially.
Absolutely. And I have to say that, you know, one of the biggest fears in life that I have is that I was in a fairly dysfunctional relationship for around 10 years, and I knew it was dysfunctional all through it. She was physically abusive to me at certain points. I had a very hard time dealing with it, but eventually I did, by just leaving the situation going on, because there didn't seem to be anything else that I could do. I do worry, and I'm terrified of how that may or may not have affected my son, who was young at the time. He's 13 years old now, and he's in honors in class, so I guess he's doing okay academically. But spiritually, emotionally, I don't know. And I don't know that I know fully yet how my own experiences with my own dysfunctional family have affected me, and I don't know that I ever will, because I'm not even sure how I would find that out.
Well, you're asking the right question that I would give right to Dr. Newhart there. How do you find out if you're getting through this okay, Dr. Newhart?
There's several ways. Having trusted friends who will tell you the truth and who themselves are sort of have their heads screwed on right is a good way of feedback. You know, we're lucky in this day and age that there's so many resources in terms of self-help books and informational sites on the internet where you can gain an awful lot of knowledge and, in fact, learn about yourself.
Well, Dr. Newhart, is what you're talking about part of what your book, one of the secrets that we keep from ourselves?
Yes, we all get in our own way from time to time. It's part of human nature. But the point is not to keep getting in your own way in the same time again and again and again. It's to learn from your mistakes. And the first step to do that is to know yourself and see what works and doesn't work in life and learn from it.
And being able to recognize you might have come from a dysfunctional family might be a pretty good secret to discover about yourself, huh?
And to see how did that affect me, and are there ways that I learned to survive a difficult upbringing that may have been necessary and appropriate in that environment, but don't serve me today. That's the essence of healing from a dysfunctional family, is to maybe give up some of the earlier patterns you had to use to survive, like maybe, you know, being secretive. And if they don't help you in life, find new patterns now.
In your middle generation, Dr. Newhart, the cumulative effect of dysfunctional families must have had an effect on the social structure of our society. From your generation's perspective, how has the dysfunctional family changed society?
I think that's a great question, and I think a sociologist or a psychologist or an engineer, everyone would look at it and come up with a different answer. The problem with a dysfunction is that the truth is generally not told, communication is generally not upfront, and emotions are generally not allowed to exist. And on a societal level, there are obvious parallels in, for example, our political process between not telling the truth about what's happening in government or in corporations, or saying one thing and doing another. There are dysfunctional corporations and dysfunctional governments and perhaps even dysfunctional society.
So, Rusty, as you mentioned, it makes you stronger. I guess in the society you live in as a younger person, you guys are stronger?
We can hope. One way to measure it might be the decline of use of the dining room table. I know lots of friends of mine who have them, but I don't know very many who actually use them to get together as a family for a meal once a day or even once a month.
Except maybe Thanksgiving, right?
Even then.
Good point.
Is it true that we tend to look for mates that remind us of our parents?
I think that that is true in two ways. Number one, because it's familiar. The way that they interact with us is familiar, and we tend to like things that are familiar. But I think it's also true in a way that can be a positive way, which is, I think deep down, we want to, whatever didn't work in the family we grew up in, we may consciously say, I never want to repeat that again.
Yes.
But unconsciously, I think a part of it says, I wish I had a chance to do that over and have a better outcome, have a healthier outcome, get what I wanted. And when you're choosing a mate, which is making a family, because you didn't choose the family you were born in, I think the unconscious part is part of it. I think it's our desire to have the same kind of challenge we had in our family, but have it turn out better. The problem is, if you pick people who are like your parents, you may get the same result that you got in your family, but not always. And that's the point of being aware of what you're doing and being able to communicate about it.
You know, Dr. Neuhart, you mentioned that, and I guess I have to throw that right back into your generation. If it's true that you might look for a mate who reflects your parents, in your generation, which has really undergone a tremendous number of divorces, is that a likely result of that thinking process, that you found someone just like your parent, mom or dad, and you really didn't like them?
I think people have always found people like their parents, but divorce wasn't necessarily an option for such an easy option. But the other thing is, you know, if you look at the history of marriage, you know, the 1950s through 40s, 50s, 60s, when there weren't that many divorces, was actually artificially very low in terms of history. Unhappy marriages and people finding ways to get out of them either legally or otherwise have been true for centuries. And so I think we see it a lot now, but I think people have always sometimes chosen badly.
So divorce has become a tool, in a way.
To try, yes. And the point is, if you choose the wrong person, to learn from it that then you choose the right person the next time.
Well, we've been talking about dysfunctional families here today on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Really had a great time talking with our guests, and I encourage you, if you've only been able to join us for part of the program, the longer version podcast is available at KUAR.org. Just click on podcast. You'll find it under Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. My guest today, speaking from the older generation, and he had to leave us a little bit earlier, has been Dr. Philip Trapp, who is an 84-year-old professor emeritus up at U of A, still a practicing clinical psychologist there in Fayetteville. Joining us from San Francisco has been Dr. Dan Neuhart in the middle generation. He's a licensed marriage family therapist, and he's been involved with clinical psychology a number of years. He's a popular speaker, a college educator, award-winning journalist, and his latest book is called Secrets You Keep From Yourself, How to Stop Sabotaging Your Happiness, and you'll find a link on our site to his books and books. He has a wonderful website there. You'll be able to check out a lot more of what he has to say. And then speaking from the younger generation, joining us from Hot Springs has been Rusty Scoggins, who is a consultant and systems engineer. Dr. Neuhart, glad you could be with us here today.
My pleasure.
Rusty, same with you. Glad you could join us.
Thank you. My pleasure, sir.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you then. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.